This is a recording from New Dominion Bookshop, brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Find out more about what we do at sevillepodcast.com. Joe Salatin of Polyface Farm appeared at New Dominion Bookshop on July 29, 2009, to read from his books Holy Cows and Hog Heaven and Everything I Want to Do is Illegal. He also took questions from the audience.
Thank you. I'm going to read the first selection from the Holy Cows and Hog Heaven book, which the subtitle is The Food Buyer's Guide to Farm-Friendly Food. As I speak around, and you know, when I first started lecturing and speaking around the country, most of the groups I spoke to were sustainable farmers or farmers who wanted to, how do you raise chickens on pasture? How do you move cows around with electric fence? It was all how-to, that sort of thing, and that reflects, you know, the early books that I wrote. But as I started doing more environmental groups and college campuses and things like that, the question started becoming, well, I don't know if I know enough to know if a farmer is true blue or not. How do I know if the farmer is really the right one that I want to buy from? And so I wrote this specifically for that. It's called The Food Buyer's Guide to Farm-Friendly Food. See, I think most food is not very farm-friendly. In fact, the fact that we now have twice as many prisoners as farmers indicates that there's something inherently farmer unfriendly about our food system, that we have eliminated that many farmers from our landscape. And so, hence the subtitle. So here we are. This is chapter 7. It's called East versus West. The United States is a culture predicated on a decidedly Western interpretation of the world. This view is rooted in the systematic reasoning and deductive logic of Greco-Roman thought. It permeated Europe and migrated with the colonists to the New World. At the risk of being oversimplistic, this worldview essentially looks at pieces as the key to the whole. Its key words are compartmentalized, disconnected, fragmented, reductionist, linear, and it glorifies the individual. It gave us systematic theology and deism. It studies parts rather than wholes. This view gave us crusaders and conquistadors. It also gave us the Renaissance, front-end loaders, electric lights, and the age of discovery. It gave us electric fences, plastic wrap, and manure spreaders. Hooray for Western thought. But wait just a minute. An equally valid worldview comes from the East. It studies the whole rather than the parts. Key words are interrelated, holism, community, we instead of I. It tends to give human characteristics to the natural world like Mother Earth. This view has given us Judaism, Hinduism, and Eastern religion. It spawned deep ecology, the environmental movement, and a reverence for nature. The clean food movement, wellness centers, and yoga sprang out of Eastern thought. Native Americans were Eastern. White Anglo-Saxon Protestants were Western. Taking the best of both worlds provides balance. Unfortunately, appreciating both is practically impossible. Neither one easily coexists with the other. Eastern thinkers worshiping and reverencing lightning never considered that it could be harnessed to electricity. Native Americans rather enjoyed being able to hunt buffalo with Western 30-30 caliber lever-action Winchester rifles, but they still reverenced the animals and did not seek to annihilate them. The same rifles in the hands of Western conquistadors, however, resulted in the annihilation of the buffalo. Eastern thought provides the moral boundary around the cleverness of Western discovery. This worldview and cultural clash is nothing new. One of my favorite historical passages comes from June 17, 1744, when the commissioners from Maryland and Virginia negotiated a treaty with the Indians of the Six Nations in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, in which the Indians were invited to send boys to William and Mary College. Here is the response from the Indians. Quote, "We know that you highly esteem the kind of learning taught in those colleges, and that the maintenance of our young men while with you would be very expensive to you. We are convinced that you mean to do us good by your proposal, and we thank you heartily. But you, who are wise, must know that different nations have different conceptions of things, and you will therefore not take it amiss if our ideas of this kind of education happen not to be the same as yours. We have had some experience of it. Several of our young people were formerly brought up at the colleges of the northern provinces. They were instructed in all your sciences. But when they came back to us, they were bad runners, ignorant of every means of living in the woods, neither fit for hunters, warriors, nor counselors. They were totally good for nothing. We are, however, not the less obliged by your kind offer, though we had declined accepting it. And to show our grateful sense of it, if the gentlemen of Virginia will send us a dozen of their sons, we will take care of their education, instruct them in all we know, and make men of them. Wouldn't it have been neat if the Westerners had appreciated this offer instead of dismissing it as worthless knowledge from a bunch of pagan barbarians who didn't even have enough sense to powder their wigs and build cobblestone streets? What a shame that we could not have coexisted and learned from each other. The Indians could have enjoyed some labor-saving machinery that and the colonists could have learned about native medicinal plants and living lightly on the land. Unfortunately, just like what usually happens when Eastern and Western worldviews come into contact, one had to dominate and conquer the other. As I write this on a decidedly Western contrivance, a Macintosh computer, my heart aches for the earthworms destroyed by mechanical fertilizer. This is the kind of dual appreciation that can move us forward. What typically happens, though, is that the environmentalist moves toward an imbalanced hatred of everything Western, and the Westerner labels everything Eastern as so much metaphysical hocus-pocus. Just as I'd like to ask Don Tyson how many chicken houses are enough, I'd like to ask the Nature Conservancy how many wilderness areas are enough. The Western ranchers using the property rights mantra to justify overgrazing and desertification are just as wrong as the Buffalo Commons folks who view private ownership of property as one of the seven deadly sins. This struggle is certainly apparent in the clean food arena. One of the biggest dilemmas facing the organic food movement right now is how to take a decidedly Eastern, connected, holistic product and sell it through a decidedly Western, disconnected, Wall Streetified marketing scheme. Now that the government has assumed ownership of the movement by defining the word organic, the modern blue coat 7th Cavalry bureaucrats are slowly and methodically doing their double duty. One, wipe out the nonconformists by either exterminating them or putting them on a reservation where they can be controlled. Or two, entice the rest to sign away their autonomy and their culture through treaties that will inevitably homogenize the differences and gradually nullify any impact from an alternative view. True progress comes when we marry Eastern indigenous heritage wisdom with appropriate Western techno-glitzy discoveries to create synergism and symbiosis. A good example of this is the new electrified poultry netting. It is polyethylene webbing with stainless steel threads woven through it. The plastic provides strength. The metal provides conductivity for an electric current. By using highly technical low-impedance energizers that can shorten the electrical pulse to microseconds, a high-voltage shock can be delivered through the threads without melting the plastic. This fence is now used all over the world by farm-friendly poultry producers to keep black bears, coyotes, dogs, raccoons, and skunks out of the chickens while keeping the chickens in. The fence can be moved easily every couple of days to give the poultry a fresh pasture paddock. It can be meandered through an orchard or vineyard as well. Who would have thought 50 years ago that you could have a fence that could keep bears and coyotes out and chickens and turkeys in that would weigh only 12 pounds per 150 feet and could be put up or taken down in 10 minutes? When dovetailed with lightweight portable hoop house structures mounted on skids, these systems allow a modern farmer to raise chickens in a more chicken-friendly environment, more hygienically, with better sanitation and predator protection, producing a more nutritious product than a backyard flock on an American homestead. Wow. Farm-friendly food asks the question, is the pig happy? On our farm and thousands like it, we try to provide a habitat to each plant and animal that allows it to fully express its physiological distinctiveness. When we respect nature or the Creator's design enough to reverence the plow on the end of a pig's nose, the graceful beak on the front of a chicken, the earthworms gamboling around in the soil underneath the cabbages, then we have a moral framework in which to contain our human cleverness. Honest food uses nature as a template placed over the production model to duplicate domestically what nature does in the wild. Our responsibility as stewards is to enhance these principles, not override them. In nature, for example, herbivores never eat grain, firm-headed forage, or carrion. I don't need a scientist to tell me feeding chicken manure and grain to cows is not a good thing to do. My Eastern framework dictates that I not feed cows these things, even if I can, and even if it makes them grow faster, and even if they seem to like it. Do you feed your kill children candy bars just because they like them? How many of us like things that aren't good for us? If you put enough sugar on it, I could probably eat cow manure. That's why the industry puts molasses in urea lick tanks and mixes in molasses and corn silage with chicken manure to make it palatable for cows. In the movie Jurassic Park, the professor is euphoric over the success of his program to resurrect long-extinct dinosaurs. The dinosaurs are eating cars with people in them, tearing down the park fences, and obviously getting ready to destroy civilization. But while the scientist celebrates, the journalist has the audacity to ask him, "But just because we can, should we?" That is a pregnant question, and one we would do well to ask ourselves every day. Just because we can feed corn to cows, should we? Just because we can plow up a 25-acre field and plant it in strawberries, should we? Just because we can air freight certified organic cut flowers from Lima, Peru to San Francisco overnight, should we? Just because we can ship certified organic yogurt from a Vermont dairy to Sacramento, should we? Just because we can buy San Joaquin Valley certified organic tomatoes in New York City in February, should we? Fast growth, profit margins, and efficiencies, these are only noble goals as long as the bigger reverence for life is maintained. Happy pigs and happy cabbages provide the most nutritious food and require the least amount of pharmaceutical intervention. As an extension of this idea, I would even suggest that our ability to coexist with people who are a little different than us is directly related to how we respect the differences in the plants and the animals. The ultimate disconnect, what in debate we used to call intellectual schizophrenia, is for patrons of environmental organizations to take their grandchildren or children by McDonald's for Happy Meals. I'm not suggesting that it is necessarily sin to ever darken the door of a fast food establishment, but once a week is ridiculous if we care, and many people are in one daily. The Western industrial paradigm raised a generation of infants on Enfamil and Similac because the Eastern natural art of breastfeeding was considered barbaric in the 1950s. This resulted in thousands of allergy sufferers and asthmatics. As the pendulum corrected itself through the hippie movement in Woodstock, the beaded, bearded, braless revolution created La Leche League, massage centers, and a new respect for alternative medicinal and herbal remedies. This whole shift is a correction to the cultural pendulum that swung too far toward the industrial model. Religiously, the charismatic movement was an Eastern answer to stodgy Western catechisms. The truth is that each side can benefit from respecting the assets that the other brings to the table. The non-industrial food movement is a direct response to over-industrialization, the disrespectful mechanistic view toward everything living. This search for meaning for the soul of food is driving everything alternative. These are interesting times for our Western culture. Watching the disequilibrium that occurs as these two worldviews jockey for position is both thrilling and terrifying. Historically, Eastern views have not fared well when confronted with Westerners. Consider the Native Americans. Consider the Incas. Consider the Aztecs. Wall Street and the Western bureaucracy will not take erosion of its market share kindly. Farm-friendly producers and farm-friendly food buyers need to be vigilant about the cultural clash. Knowing about it is empowering. That's not the whole chapter, but it's a good place to stop. So that's just a little piece from Holy Cows and Hog Heaven. And we want to discuss that a little bit or take a couple comments or questions or anything before we go to the next one. It might not be what you thought it was, but it's pretty eclectic. You know, I go pretty broad a field to try to help us get the big picture and understand food. Yes?
I'm curious.
Yeah, well, my grandfather Dad's father was a charter subscriber to Rodale's Organic Gardening and Farming magazine when it first came out in whatever, like 1949, 50. A lot of people don't realize that right after World War II was a pretty big watershed in food in this country. Some of you may have heard of the name Lewis Bromfield, who wrote he was the John Grisham of the World War II era. He wrote something like 16 novels, extremely famous. He was very wealthy, a friend of every celebrity in Hollywood. Laura Bacall was married in his house in Ohio, and hobnobbed with the world leaders. And he was up for Secretary of Agriculture and completely endorsed the artisanal, compost, non-chemical type of farming. And there was a tremendous push for him to be appointed Secretary of Agriculture in like 1950, and he suddenly died. Been all sorts of conspirators that think that he was murdered or whatever. Nobody knows. But the fact is that once he was kind of taken off that national stage, the country went very fast toward chemical agriculture. And so my grandfather was an early adherent to that idea, started the Rodale Empire, Ed Faulkner, and then, of course, a decade later, Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring. And that, of course, is kind of attributed as the beginning of the really environmental movement. So Dad got his kind of environmental conservation bent from his dad, and I got it from Dad. So I'm just a lunatic genetically, you know. Good question. Thank
you.
Yeah, I was raised here. I've been here since I was four. I'm second generation here. Yes. Yeah, we came here when I was four. I mean, we lost a farm in Venezuela. Dad was there for 14 years in Venezuela. I was, of course, I spoke Spanish before English. But the farm got taken in a political coup and expatriated or expropriated or whatever. And we basically, fled out the back doors. The guerrillas came in the front door, and Dad lost everything. And he was 42 at the time. Had been there for 14 years. So some of my political eclecticism is, based on those kinds of things. That's one reason why I'm not in favor of any foreign aid of any kind, because it's all squandered and whatever, props up the rich in the cities and abuses the poor people in the countryside. All of it. All of it. All of it.
Okay.
Yeah. And of course, doesn't matter who's in office, Democrats, Republicans, whatever, they're all big on giving our money away. Peace Corps, same problem. Same thing. Yeah. You wouldn't believe how many apprentices we've had who have left the Peace Corps because it's just bureaucratic and just lines the pockets of the big corporations. We had a guy come by just lately that had just left USAID in Africa, and he was so tired of what they were doing, USAID, to displace the indigenous farmers. And he finally asked and finally went up the chain of command until he finally got to one of the very top level people in USAID, and she looked at him and she said, "You don't understand. USAID is there to make those farmers completely dependent on American exports." This is a real world, folks. Okay, want to do the other one? You ready? Innovation demands embryonic births. The problem is that complying with these governmental codes requires that even the prototype must be too big to be birthed. In reality, then, what we have are stillbirth dreams because the mandated... This is from Everything I Want to Do is Illegal. War stories from the local food front. Okay. Too big to be birthed. In reality, then, what we have are stillbirth dreams because the mandated accoutrements are too big. Here's an analogy. We're all familiar with eBay, a true American cultural phenomenon. And who would want to see it disappear? Just imagine the following requirements before you could list an item on eBay. A license certifying you are qualified to operate your computer. Occupational Safety and Health Administration certificate certifying that your computer desk and office are splinter-free, handicapped accessible, and non-injurious to you. Electrician certificate verifying that the electrical cords running to the computer are up to code. Fire marshal license that you have a fire extinguisher in working order, properly checked on the wall in case your hot item becomes too hot to handle. Government labeling verification that your description of said item is indeed accurate and not misrepresented in any way. Building inspection license indicating the structural soundness of the room and computer desk in the immediate vicinity of where you will be doing eBay business on your computer. What if the room caved in on you right when your hot buyer was on the line? The potential buyer might suffer emotional trauma in the fallout of your room falling in. Securities and Exchange Commission license for your banking and accounting showing that you can indeed transact financial matters and that you are properly indemnified against product liability. I could go on in this vein for a while, but I think the point is abundantly clear. Would eBay have ever existed had all these requirements been placed on it? Indeed, would anyone today use it were these requirements in place? And yet, it is an entirely self-policing system for all of these elements. How can that be? The reason is that it is transparent and has a dramatic feedback loop for customer comments. A shyster simply doesn't last long in this market climate. eBay works because anyone can try it without investing in any extra infrastructure. It utilizes already owned computers. It's a true free market entity and, of course, drives retailers crazy. The retail industry lobbies hard to clamp down on this freewheeling phenom. But fortunately, eBay freedom still exists. Because anyone with a computer and an item can launch a transaction, it epitomizes the embryonic prototype, and its dramatic success shows the validity of this concept. The same is true with any business. Only the foolish or independently wealthy can afford to birth a 100-pound baby. Most of us need some time to grow into our adolescence, and that means we must preserve the freedom to access the market on a tiny scale or innovation cannot occur. Today's big food businesses began from the tailgate of a pickup truck in the 1940s and 1950s before food safety laws became as onerous as they are today. If we do not preserve this type of market access for future generations, we not only keep a generation of young people from realizing their dreams, but we deny the entire culture the innovative prototypes necessary to truly solve problems. If every baby must be born too big to be viable, the babies die. And it's the babies that have the new ideas, that dare to question old paradigms, that move a culture forward. And to me, one of the benchmark attitudes that distinguishes evil-hearted people from good-hearted people is their attitude toward babies. In the natural progression of business, a prototype outgrows the kitchen sinks, for example, and eventually does require a separate building and some snazzy stainless steel furniture. For example, on our farm, we did not install a walk-in freezer and cooler until we had 13 home-style chest and upright freezers. Then we made the leap to the upgrade, and a huge investment it was, but we grew into it. If my home kitchen pound cake prototypes are well received, eventually I outgrow the kitchen and build a bigger one with bigger mixing bowls and larger sinks. But if I must build a $50,000 freestanding commercial kitchen before I even experiment to find out if baking pound cakes is something I enjoy, I will never bake the first one. And herein lies the great conundrum of this book. My passion is to recreate in our culture a sense of loss. I lie awake at night trying to figure out how to get people to understand what we've lost. I'm desperate for a food NRA, National Rifle Association. The reason the NRA exists and is such a powerful organization is because such a huge number of Americans own guns, and they don't want to lose them. The fear of the loss motivates us to join the NRA and to passionately defend America's first freedom. The only reason we don't have a food NRA is because it's hard to create a need for something that does not exist. It's hard to get people passionately exercised about something they don't have. In a nutshell, the goal of this book is to give Americans an insatiable appetite for something they don't have. I want folks to leave these pages angry that they've been denied something righteous, something helpful. I want folks incensed that their government has sold our collective freedom birthright for a bowl of global corporate outsourced pottage. If you've never tasted real homemade jams and jellies, you don't know what you're missing. If you've never tasted an on-farm processed pastured broiler, then Whole Foods Organic will do just fine, thank you. But once you've tasted the real deal, Nothing else satisfies. I don't know how many times our customers tell us, you've ruined us, meaning that they just can't go back to normal food, even certified Empire Organic. I had a restaurant chef a week ago get all weak kneed on me when he found out that we were out of eggs. What am I supposed to do? He lamented. Eye hath not seen nor ear heard, to paraphrase a biblical description of God's plans, what could be if local food entrepreneurs were freed up to access their neighborhoods with homemade artisanal food. Let me just for a moment describe what would happen. We'd enjoy muffins from our neighbors' kitchens, pickles, salsa, and baked goods. We'd have locally grown and cured ham and bacon. Local beef jerky would accompany our kiddos' lunch boxes. Frozen heat-and-eat quiche made from overabundant pastured spring eggs from the neighbor's flock would offer quickie meals on soccer night. Chicken pot pies made with grandma's recipe in our neighbor's kitchen could be purchased during that mad dash home from work, what's for supper panic. We could enjoy a Delmonico's steak from a pastured steer that never stepped onto a trailer to be commingled at a slaughterhouse with animals of dubious extraction while awaiting slaughter, but rather was killed on its home farm in reverence by the farmer who cared for it, tender and beyond description. All of this washed down with wine from the neighbor's grapes, fermented lovingly in his basement, under the watchful eye of the children and the family cat. Cheese all sorts of fresh and aged, straight from the neighbor's 10-cow pastured dairy herd, and ice cream to die for from heavy cream and molasses grown, milled, and canned 2 miles down the road. Are you salivating yet? You see, an embedded local food system could actually exist in the midst of subdivisions and strip malls. Wherever a few unpaved square feet poke through, edible plants and animals could be grown and processed for the neighborhood. And without the expensive labeling, packaging, and processing infrastructure requirements, this food could be sold at regular supermarket prices, and it would be infinitely better. Virtually all of the processed foods currently sold at the supermarket could be supplanted with community-based entrepreneurial fare. Does your heart ache for this? Mine does. Well, why can't we just have this? Because everyone is paranoid of the unscrupulous. I was eating dinner with a couple of sustainable agriculture professors from the University of Iowa. They were appalled that I would suggest we allow unfettered market access to cottage-based food producers. But you can't just let food on the market that isn't regulated, they spluttered. What about dirty kitchens, the dishonest people? It was a lively discussion, and we concluded with my question, okay, then what would you do? Sleep on it and tell me in the morning. We parted amicably. My goodness, these were my friends. I realized that if I couldn't sell them the idea of an unfettered entrepreneurial food system, then I certainly couldn't sell the idea to anyone else. These folks knew all about the evils of industrial food systems, the environmental footprint of outsourced food, and the failure of U.S. agriculture policy. I was frankly shocked that they, too, had swallowed this paranoia that assumes everyone selling an item is untrustworthy. So I put the question to them, and they promised to have an answer for me by morning on our shuttle ride to the airport. Morning came. Okay, what did you come up with? Nothing. We don't have an answer. That was it. Here, these people are nationally recognized, published professors of sustainable agriculture, and they have no idea how to create a local food system. Well-versed in low-chemical production models, companion planting techniques, composting, they failed to make the connection between stewarding the land and stewarding the farmer's profitability, and ultimately the community's sustainability via a local food web. That conversation helped me to understand the dilemma we face as people like me preach local food systems. The current alternative food movement grew out of the back-to-the-land Mother Earth movement of communes, hippies, and Woodstock. Completely disenfranchised from Wall Street and the establishment, these visionaries sought a different direction for our country through government. We can cure pollution with the Environmental Protection Agency. We can cure abusive animal practices with more regulations. We can heal the forest by taking land away from the private sector and expanding wilderness areas. We could end poverty with more welfare and social programs. It was virtually a top-down mentality. Indeed, this is still evidenced by the organic movement that asked for government certification. People like me prophesied that when the government controlled the movement, the little guys would be squeezed out, the standards would be gradually adulterated until organic meant nothing, and it would simply be a way for multinational globalists to hijack organics. And at the time, people like me were laughed to scorn by those who really believed the government could help out. A few tax dollars here, and there would be wonderful. This idea is still alive and well. I was recently contacted by a leading sustainable agriculture lobbying group to sign on to a letter delineating policy positions for the new farm bill. First part demanded a cap on subsidies to individual farms. Many people don't realize that wealthy landowners and mega corporate outfits enjoy the lion's share of farm subsidies. Well, I was okay with the caps. But the second part of the lobbyist agenda demanded that the money saved from capping would be given to sustainable farmers instead. What? How disingenuous can we be? Here, our side has been decrying this inappropriate subsidy for decades, and then we demand to pig out at the public trough too? Where's the high moral ground in that position? To the proponents of an industrial food system, if we lobby to partake, we are no better than they. Anyway, the alternate food system grew out of this government-can-fix-it mentality. For lack of better terms than just to push the discussion to a conclusion, I'll call this a more liberal idea as opposed to the conservatives who took a more limited government position. The leaders of the clean food movement, by and large, still adhere to this liberal idea and vote Democratic. Many have voted for Ralph Nader and the Green Party. The problem with the government fix is that while it may start sincerely, by the time it gets implemented on the ground and has been through the sieve of corporate dinners, it hurts the little guys and helps the big guys. Case in point. Consumer advocates proposed several years ago to require daily testing for pathogens on poultry. Each slaughter facility would have to take a swab test. One catch, it would cost $300. Now, to Tyson or Pilgrim's Pride, that's a spit in the ocean. Their electric bill to maintain cool drinking water is more than $300 a day. But to a small pastured poultry outfit like ours, that's the whole day's profit. End of the little guy. That is reality. And unless you've had a small business, it's hard to appreciate the unintended consequences of these wonderful sounding proposals. Of course, the other side is equally discriminatory. When the Republicans propose business incentives and tax breaks for business, they end up lining the pockets of the big players. And it's such a common occurrence now that corporate welfare is synonymous with Republicanism, and it's rotten. As an example, I was interviewed by Pat Buchanan on his radio show when Bill Clinton was in the White House. It was shortly after news hit the food sections that Bill and Hillary hired a French chef who vowed that he would serve only free-range chicken. That was just too juicy for the conservatives to let go. Buchanan found me and put me on the show. He asked me what the difference was between regular chicken and free range. Of course, I didn't use free range, I used pastured. I explained that for one thing, our chickens didn't do drugs. Well, why do they give drugs in the big houses? He asked. Well, for one thing, it makes them grow faster. He cut me off. How could anything be bad that makes them grow faster? I was incredulous. Cancer is fast growth. But this shows the conservative disrespect for biological and environmental realities. For crying out loud, we should be able to all understand that if growing it faster, bigger, fatter, cheaper were a good goal, we'd all aspire to be the fattest person in the room. But this is the problem with the conservatives. They measure growth only in terms of gross domestic product. Truly, if the liberals have no head, the conservatives have no heart. Okay, I have the rare joy of being able to make everyone mad at me at the same time. Rare gift, I know. Okay.
So have you seen any movement in Virginia about away from regulations?
No. In general, more and more regulations are coming, especially on the federal. Virginia has been fairly quiet. It's the federal right now that's really, really bad. There's a House Bill 2749, I think it is. It was supposed to go to a vote yesterday. I think it got delayed till today. A couple of provisions, just one that you need just to see how bad it is. This is the 2009 Food Safety Enhancement Act. And it gives the FDA authority to visit, without a warrant, any farm in the United States to determine if anything is being done that is not science-based. Well, you know what science-based is. Science-based is mandatory vaccinations, pharmaceuticals, genetic engineering, irradiation, go on down the line, all right, chemical agriculture, concentrated animal feeding operations, Tyson's. I mean, that's what's science-based. And so so there are in California now, in the leafy green industry, they have outlawed children under five on farms because of the... because there can be no diaper on a farm. I mean, we are heading, these are unprecedented draconian measures by an organization, the USDA, the FDA, that considers it safe when you feed your children Cocoa Puffs and Twinkies and Mountain Dew, but it's not safe to give them compost-grown tomatoes and pasture-based chicken. The Virginia Poultry Federation went on record in 2002 that we, at our farm, were bioterrorists because our chickens commiserate with red-winged blackbirds and carry diseases to the science-based Tyson chicken houses and jeopardize the entire planet's food system. This is the, see, what's happening now is that as our movement, and I'm assuming most people here have an appreciation for, you know, organic food and compost piles and pastured livestock and, you know, this sort of thing. You're not, you know, you're not friends of Tyson or whatever, Monsanto. And what's happening now is as this movement grows and permeates more of the market, we are chipping away at market share. I mean, look at the explosive growth of farmers markets, the explosive, I mean, right here in Charlottesville, the food initiatives, the, I can't even think of them all. I mean, I get mailings and I see them, but you know, the pantry, the kitchen, the Kate Collier, is that?
Food Hub. Yeah.
Food Hub, yes, yes. All the things that are developing around, I mean, it's just happening at an unprecedented rate. And what all of these represent is people who are exercising their individual freedom of choice to opt out of industrial supermarket fare. And the margins are so small at the industrial food systems that the only way that they can maintain viability is to either marginalize, demonize, or criminalize that choice as being unsafe for your health. I mean, you can't drink a glass of raw milk in Virginia. Why? You know, when the government gets between my lips and my stomach, that's a pretty cozy invasion of privacy. And I suggest that we have the freedom in our country to have a gun, to worship, to speak. Well, my question is, what good are those freedoms if we don't have the freedom of choice to decide the fuel to feed our 3 trillion member internal community to give us the energy to go shoot, pray, and preach? You know, the only reason that the founders did not guarantee us those freedoms in the Bill of Rights, along with gun ownership and worship and preaching, was because they couldn't have imagined a day when it would be illegal for you to exercise your freedom of choice to buy a glass of raw milk from your neighbor's cow, or a pound cake from your neighbor's 10-year-old daughter that wants to make pound cakes, or whatever. They couldn't have imagined that day, and yet that day is here. I'm not trying to scare everybody, but trust me, the backlash, and if you go see Fresh this evening and Food Inc., believe me, you know, if you go to the Monsanto website, they're devoting huge manpower or person power. I'm sure they have plenty of female clever speak specialists who are combating these two movies and you know, saying that they're encouraging people to eat unsafe food and they're encouraging all this. It's pretty amazing. Other questions, comments? Yes.
I'm a tree. I'm the mother of 12 children, and sort of your discussion about embryos and how we, or you know, sort of a movement with these young children. Are there any success stories on, or sort of strategies that you know of that do encourage sort of a little ones to sort of start thinking about these issues? I'm thinking about, you know, the homemade jam, what was maybe missing in my education growing up. Are there any models that you know of in communities that are
Oh yes, all of the local initiatives that are occurring, farmers markets on down, okay, community supported agriculture, metropolitan buying clubs, all of these initiatives. I mean, there's distribution networks starting. There's a Shenandoah Pastoral Guild that started up. There's a Kentucky has a group called Grasshoppers that's a 30 farmer distribution network. This is happening all over the country. It's huge, and that's what, you know, the old, for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. So as we act, as we activate our choice to not get industrial stuff, then they act in reaction to it, Of course, we're reacting to their action. I mean, you know, what comes first, chicken or the egg? You know? And the fact is that every time there's a new E. coli outbreak, salmonella, whatever, another big bunch of eaters throw away their Smithfield pork and go looking for something else. All right, that's the truth. In the industry, of course, the safe answer is not reduce the overcrowding, decentralize pig production, put them on grass, and that sort of thing. The answer is mandatory irradiation. So what will happen is the consumer advocacy groups will push through mandatory irradiation so I can't even sell a pastured pig to you that hasn't been irradiated. And of course, our little abattoir that we now, Teresa and I now co-own up in Harrisburg, T&E Meats, Let me tell you how this. So there are lots of local initiatives that are all really going, and that's why it's interesting that the states are not being nearly aggressive as the federal, because the big Tysons, the Cargills, the Monsantos are seeing their market share erode, and so they're trying to use their influence in Washington to create these kinds of things to just criminalize what we do. I was recently asked by Congressman, if I didn't think of it, I wouldn't. No. This was Ohio. He was a Democratic presidential candidate at the beginning before Obama emerged at the... Kucinich. Yes, thank you, Kucinich. Convened a congressional hearing after the undercover Humane Society agent, the cows in California in that slaughterhouse that were being killed and pushed around with the forklifts and all, trying to make them stand up enough to be killed. He convened this on about how do we make the meat industry of the U.S. safe. Okay, I was one of 10 testifiers, and it was pretty heady. I mean, I was official. I wasn't an imposter. I was actually asked to come and testify. And interestingly, 8 of the 10 asked for mandatory 24/7 video camera surveillance of every abattoir in the U.S. with the film coverage being beamed to a big federal bureaucratic Food Safety Inspection Service monitor. That would have software created so that certain movements or actions would trigger a red flag, and make a person have to look at that particular monitor. And of course, this can be done, and it only costs, $5 million. Well, if you're a Cargill or a Tyson and you're running $50 million worth of product through your plant every single day, $5 million is a kind of hit, but it can be done. But if you're an embedded community-based abattoir, like we have in Harrisonburg, that does 10 beeves a week and 20 hogs and 10 lambs and 3 goats, that puts you out of business. And that's why every single time in 1947, in 1967, and in 2002, the three big watershed years where the USDA revamped food safety laws, all three of those times, within 24 months of each of those 3 years, our country lost half of its community abattoirs. And of course, what was interesting about this hearing was that one of the invited testifiers happens to be the president of a company that sells this equipment. And he gave a nice professional PowerPoint on the wall showing what his company could do to save us all. And of course, my answer is free up the entrepreneurial indigenous local food system so that we can have this vibrant local source. New Scientist had a fascinating article in it recently that it was very fascinating. It said that in science, every time you innovate something, you always innovate it with a prototype first, small-scale prototype first. Then if it's successful, then you can make it bigger. And it said that in American politics, we don't have a way to have political prototypes. For example, what would be wrong with Congress passing a law saying that a locality, say Charlottesville, if Charlottesville wanted to have a local food regulation-free zone, could do it. But see, we can't do that. We don't have that freedom. My point being that if a county or a city would just try a truly embedded, bring the butcher, baker, and candlestick maker back into the village and embed them in there, what would happen is people wouldn't be as sick. You know, you wouldn't have as many people in hospitals. You wouldn't have as much ADD. You wouldn't have as much blah, blah. I mean, I know that would happen. But it would be really interesting to test it somewhere first. But we can't test it because it's illegal. See? And it was a really interesting article. I'd never heard that take from a political standpoint, that we've so criminalized everything that we can't even attempt innovative prototypes to even bring something to the table. Because that's our problem. I mean, I can say all this. I can say that for sure we would eat better food. It'd be more nutritious. People would be healthier. We have hospitals wouldn't be as busy, which would solve the healthcare problem. I mean, Tom Perriello said in Washington, D.C., the last time I was up there, he said, ultimately the healthcare crisis is a food crisis. He's exactly right. He's exactly right. And so it was just interesting to see the prototype idea addressed as a scientific problem and not a political problem. I just find that really creative thinking. Yes, ma'am.
So the Amish and the Mormons who do what you're talking about, have they been tested and have they been scrutinized for better health because of the way they do things?
They don't do things like us.
I know.
They don't. They don't do things even like us. There's nothing healthy about the Amish. I mean, the Amish, they go to farmer's market, and I was just in Holmes County, Ohio, and spoke to 3,000 Amish 2 Saturdays ago. You know what I told them? I said, you know what the problem with you? You know why all you guys stink and your teeth rot out? Because all you guys bring this wonderful produce to farmer's market and bake this wonderful homemade ground bread to sell. But you go by, you know, Kroger's and Walmart and get the crash and dented stuff and go eat feed your own families because you're too stinking frugal to eat good food. And they all knew that's exactly right. I've had hundreds of Amish tell me that's exactly why they have so many health problems. A third of all the Amish in Holmes County are on Prozac for antidepressant. Listen, listen, this Amish Mennonite myth is for the, I mean, there's nothing good, sanitary, special. Now, there are some really wonderful ones, and at the same time, look, here's the thing. The Amish are just like the Presbyterians, or just like the Catholics, or just like the Hindus, okay? There's good ones and there's bad ones, okay? And this idea of Amish country butter, whatever, it's a crock. It's an absolute crock. Yes. Yes, literally. Yes.
To this point, most of sort of the information that I feel like I've gotten from this movement is a bit about how to eat better, how to buy things differently, and then this book is more geared towards politics than is being illegal to do, which I don't feel like you probably can change just by buying things. What are the key channels of political influence? I mean, you're saying USDA or FDA?
No, I think I wrote this book not so that people would go march on Washington. I wrote this book so that you would realize that part of your food choice future is getting your neighbors to eat this way, and your mother to eat this way, and your son to eat this way. Because the only way that this agenda can move forward is if there aren't very many of us. Look, here, so the power, it is to empower us A, knowledge is power. And the fact is, most people have no clue of the hoops that local farmers run through to get you anything. Okay? I mean, the reason that our bacon from our farm is $9 a pound is not because it costs so much to produce it or because, you know, pasture-based farming is inefficient. It's because in order for me to sell you a pound of bacon from my pig grown and raised on my farm, A, it can't be slaughtered on my farm. It has to be slaughtered in a federal inspected slaughterhouse, which is illegal in an agricultural zone, so I couldn't even have one if I wanted one. So I got to load it in a trailer, take it up to a slaughterhouse, okay, which is very small, and these regulations are non-scalable, so it costs me $1.30 a pound to have it processed. What Smithfield, because of their economies of scale, can do for 25 cents a pound, well, we've just added $1 a pound just because of the economies of scale in embedded processing. Then it has to go to a federal inspected curing facility, which is up in Wolftown, Virginia, up in Madison County. They charge $5 a pound for curing it, which all the farmers around Virginia cured pork, the reason is because everybody used to cure this stuff at home and nobody ever got sick, okay? But I have to pay $5 a pound. So by the time I get it home, I have $6.30 a pound in it just to get it home, and I haven't paid for feed, labor, transportation, or anything. The point is that if I could kill it at home like we used to do, the old Thanksgiving hog killings, if I could cure it in my smokehouse, which all of our old farms have, and if I could do that, I could give you artisanal quality bacon at cheaper than you could get it Gwaltney at Walmart. That's the truth. And the reason that our movement has been marginalized and so many industrial, you know, a bunch of little elitists over there, you know, with your expensive grapes and your expensive blah, blah, blah. The reason for all that is because of this regulatory environment. So that was another myth that I wanted to blow, was this inherently pricey local food stuff is not inherently pricey. It's only pricey because of non-scalable, inapplicable. Let me tell you one more that just happened to us. Last year, our farm got big enough. I mean, I'm not saying we want to be big. I'm just saying that we hired the final person that threw us into legally having to join workman's compensation, Virginia Workman's Comp. Okay, well, of course, you know, you have to register your business, and your business has to fit their box. In other words, they don't make new boxes. They've only got a certain number of boxes. Well, the box for us is farm. Okay, farm. Well, so we have a delivery driver who delivers through, you know, he delivers to Fleury and L'Etoile and Keswick and all these restaurants through Charlottesville and Foods of All Nations and Feast and all this. Okay, he delivers boxes of eggs and, you know, packages of meat and fresh chickens, okay? They're slaughtered chickens. They don't have feathers on them. They're table ready, okay? Boxes of stuff. But since we're a farm, we can't have that kind of delivery driver. The only kind of delivery driver we can have is a delivery driver who is called a live animal hauler, who is loading 1,000-pound steers in a trailer from a corral, which is the highest risk occupation there is in the whole shooting match, costs us an extra $3,000 a year in workman's comp because we're a farm and can't have somebody delivering boxes. So guess who pays for that extra $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 worth of workman's comp? You do.
Will the food hub help
that? I don't know.
Will you be able to have things delivered through them? That's what they're trying to do, isn't it?
To tell you the truth, I've seen some of the literature. We're not ready to use the food hub. I don't know. I just have to punt on the food hub thing. I'm not up on it. So I don't know if it will or not. I don't know. But obviously, collaboration with processing seems like a good idea. The question is the pricing structure and, you know, costs. And, of course, they're fighting economies of scale, too. and whatever inspections the food hub has to have in their processing facility, again, it's going to be very difficult to scale those requirements. And so they're going to have a very high processing cost because of scale. So ultimately, what I'm in favor of is a two-tiered system. Look, if you want to buy stuff from... Michael Pollan and I talked about this the last time we were together in Berkeley. Because my libertarian... Because I tend to brush lightly... You know, and I'm just being very transparent. I'm so prejudiced against government that I'm not willing to concede food safety requirements are necessary. And so I tend to be a little bit cavalier about food safety. And he comes from the more, you know, democratic kind of, Democrat kind of side of things, the greeny liberal kind of deal. And feels like we need something. Okay, so here was our discussion, and here's what we came up with. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being Aunt Matilda's Sunday dinner, she has a big garden out back, and she has a chicken pen, and she invites your family over for Sunday dinner, okay? She goes out and picks the beets and the carrots and, you know, kills the chicken and makes chicken and dumplings, okay, and has you over for dinner, okay? And a 10 being a happy meal from McDonald's, okay? Here's the question. Should the happy meal from McDonald's be subject to food safety regulations and governmental oversight and inspection? Yes. I haven't had anybody that shook their head no on that, okay? Yes, all right? Now, the question is, what about that Aunt Matilda Sunday afternoon dinner? What do you think about that? No! She invited you over for dinner.
It's not a comparison. She's not selling anything. McDonald's.
Well, let me tell you a secret, sir. The last time I was in Washington, I put that question to Senator Jim Webb's agricultural legislative aide, and he said that even her dinner needed government inspection.
Oh, really?
Well, there is no.
That's the truth. That is the truth. That is the truth. In Ontario, you cannot give away uninspected food. At least here, we can still give it away. John and Christine Solomon at Satterfield, you know, they're still giving away their cheese, okay? Here, we can still give it away. In Ontario, you can't give it away anymore.
But Ontario, Canada.
Ontario, Canada.
Right,
yeah, but all I'm saying is...
Invite someone to have carrots that you grew without state inspection.
Well, this new law now, this one that I just mentioned, this HB 2749, I think it is, or 89, it, for the first time, defines food establishment, which has always been defined as a commercial enterprise, you know, in the buying and selling and commerce of food. It defines food establishment as any place in America that prepares food, period. That's your kitchen. That's my kitchen. Folks, Monsanto is evil.
But how are they going to do that? How are they going to come to my kitchen? How are they going to?
Let me ask you something. If you had lived in Germany in 1935 and somebody told you we're going to kill 5 million Jews, what would you have said? Nah, that's crazy. They'd never do that. See? So never say it can't happen. Never, please, never say that. Because believe me, the machinations of an evil mind are way beyond what you and I... Now, I'm not here to get everybody all despondent. What I am here for is to energize everybody to grow more carrots and milk your cow and make your pot pies and discover your kitchen and enjoy the romance and the joy of eating your own food and having true food security that doesn't come from food irradiated embedded in a Chinese merchant marine for 3 months. You know, that's where food security is.